Sorry, my puppy is he was stepping on my court, so I had to grab him.
Puppy is a good example of the face.
Dude, I was just thinking that. Hey, welcome back to another episode of Parker's Pensies. I'm your host, Parker Setacase, and this is a podcast where we explore all the deepest ideas in philosophy, theology, nature, and life. I really love thinking about cool stuff, so come think with me. Today's episode is going to be a really challenging one for me, but I picked it because I need to learn this stuff. So we're going to be talking about Sordles. If you don't know what those are, stay tuned. You're going to learn all about Sordles. You're going to be an expert after this. So yeah, that's going to be great. I have with me Dr. Justin Mooney, and he just finished up at UMass teaching philosophy there. And I think there's a big announcement coming, not on this channel, but you guys can look forward to that, where he's at. He is a hippo enthusiast as well, as you all see. I'm excited. We're going to talk about a recent paper that he just produced. I think it was just released today for Noose, and it's about Sordles and his unique take on Sordles. We're going to go at all the substantialists when it comes to Sordles. So stay tuned. You're going to learn all about this. It's going to be metaphysics heavy. I'm excited for it. But before we jump in, I want to thank everyone who's making this podcast happen by supporting it on Patreon. The Patreon patrons are the best. I love you guys so much. Thank you for supporting the podcast. If you've benefited from this podcast yourself and you haven't yet jumped on board on Patreon, please consider doing that. You can find the link in the description wherever you're getting this podcast at, and you can join for various different amounts every month. You can do 3, 5, all the way up to 100. If you commit to 100, then you are basically part of my family. You can find that there. There's lots of different benefits that come at different levels. So please do consider that. And if not, or if you want to go above and beyond, you can find the super thanks button right around here. And you can just give a one-time gift to say super thanks. That would be huge. Awesome. All right. Well, that's enough of that. Let's jump in on Sordles with Dr. Justin Mooney. Justin, thanks so much for coming on the podcast, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited. Should be fun conversation.
Yeah. I've been wanting to do this for a while, and I saw you post about this paper on Sordles, and I was like, okay, I hear people talk about Sordles. I have a very loose grasp on it of what they mean, and so I need to like force myself in on it. So I'm really excited, and I was going to bring up how you talk about hippos all the time in your class, and I was going to kind of razz you about that, but then I see you show up with the most hippos I've ever seen in my life, so you beat me to it there. What's with the hippos for the audience?
Yeah, I just love hippos. They're my favorite animal, and okay. I love animals in general, so I really love hippos. But yeah, awesome. When I teach all of my classes, I do daily hippo facts, one each class session at the beginning. Okay. It's one of the things that students like the best about my classes.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, they were saying that on your teacher reviews.
Yeah.
So good. Well, Justin, I hate to put you on the spot here, man, but do you have a hippo fact for us today?
Sure, yeah. One of my favorites is that hippos secrete this sweat-like substance.
Okay.
That has like 4 or 5 different functions. It works as sunblock, insect repellent, antibacterial, air conditioning, skin moisturizer, and the coolest thing is it's pink. So they basically have pink sweat.
What? That's crazy.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. I know there's some frogs that have like the sunscreen type of stuff, but I did not know that about hippos. That is a good hippo fact, man. Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. Thank you for that.
Yeah, you like frogs, don't you?
I love frogs. I love turtles. That's my jam. Yeah. I love dogs. Animals are awesome. I love animals.
What is your favorite species of frog?
Oh, man. There's so many really cool ones, but I think probably giant African bullfrogs. That's what I have.
Same.
Dude, let's go.
Favorite species of frog as well.
That's crazy. Oh, holy cow.
They're like the hippo of frogs. They're so fat.
They are. They're African animals are really cool. You know, like just there's something about them. And they're all like crazy. You know, I mean, hippos, they got those nasty teeth and everything. I heard they're responsible for more deaths than crocodiles. Is that?
Yeah.
You're the guy to ask on that. That's true.
Yes, that's true.
Okay, wow. Yes.
They also sometimes bite crocodiles in half, apparently.
Jeez.
At least one of my books as a kid, one of my hippo books told me that. So if that's a reliable source.
Yeah, right. Well, so the giant African bullfrogs, they got these nasty two, I don't know, odontoids or something. Two, like, they look like teeth. And then they got a bunch of little cat teeth on top, and they are nasty, man. They're you don't want to get bit by them. But yeah, I actually have three of them right now. So that's
awesome.
Yeah, I have. Man, a lot of people don't know this, but I'll just plug my other YouTube channel. I have another YouTube channel all about frogs and turtles. Did you know that, Justin?
I think, yeah, I haven't checked it out, but I heard from somebody.
My whole goal with this one is to try and beat that channel, because that channel, I have a video that got 48 million views. And
Really?
I'm like, I put in so much work into this, and I don't do anything with that, and everyone watches that stuff. But anyways, getting back to the philosophy that everyone's here for, the 48 million people who are going to watch this one. yeah, we're going to be talking about your paper, Criteria of Identity Without Sortles. Just real quick, though, I was interested in finding out, how did you get into philosophy at all? How did you want to become a professional philosopher?
Yeah, it was sort of a weird, circuitous path, because it definitely wasn't my original plan. Hmm. In fact, my undergraduate degree was basically in kids' book illustration.
What? That's cool.
It was definitely a shift. But, like, you know, I started to become interested late high school and college. I started to become interested in questions in, like, apologetics and theology that mm-hmm. were relevant to my religious beliefs. And so, I became interested in reading all about that. And that interest just kind of grew and grew. And eventually I sort of outgrew the popular level apologetics type stuff. And yeah. Became exposed to, you know, more academic work. And anyway, so I just kind of, you know, that just sort of blossomed, and I ended up, you know, switching tracks from art to philosophy.
Yeah. Wow. Do you still mess with art at all yourself?
Not very much. It's something that I just strangely perhaps kind of grew tired of after a while. Yeah.
That's sad, because I was really hoping for a kid's book on Sortles. That would be really nice.
Yeah. Some people have tried to get me to do, like, an illustrated philosophy for kids kind of book. But there's already some stuff like that out there. So.
Okay.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Okay. Yeah. So you ended up doing a master's in philosophy of religion at TEDS. Is that right?
Yeah. So that was like my transition from art to philosophy. I did it by way of that TEDS degree, because they were willing to take me even though I had almost no official philosophy background at that point. And it was also like my first interest in philosophy. Initially, what I was most interested in was philosophy of religion, and that was what that program focused on.
Yeah, it's perfect. And we had a mutual mentor there Harold Netland. Holy cow. I almost forgot Dr. Netland's name. Yeah. I love that guy so much. So
yeah,
you got into, he's just the man, dude. Not enough people talk about him, but I love that guy.
I know. He is so wonderful. I definitely made it a point to keep up correspondence with him since leaving TESS, because he is just a wonderful person. And he's great.
Yeah. Really is. So you got in on philosophy of religion. What'd you end up doing your PhD on then?
Yeah, so it's in philosophy, but I specialized, I list as my areas of specialization philosophy of religion and metaphysics.
Okay.
But my dissertation was on a topic in metaphysics. It was about this sortle thing that we're going to
talk about. Oh, sweet, dude. This, we're right in your wheelhouse then. I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's huge. Well, okay, so we've used the word a few times here. What is a sortle?
Yeah, the short answer is nobody knows.
Great.
But here's a more helpful and also maybe not too long of an answer. So when you think about, like, all the different objects there are in the world, they come in different sorts, right? There are lots of different sorts of things. There are hippos and books and trees and cars, right? So sortals correspond to the different sorts of things. Mm. Now, some philosophers like to talk about sortal terms. And so these would be terms like the word hippo, yeah. right? Or the word tree or whatever, right? And some philosophers like to talk about sortal concepts. So like the concept of a hippo or the concept of a car. And especially like if you look in like the 70s and 80s, a lot of the literature on sortals and things where sortals were relevant was in terms of concepts and sortal terms.
Right around that conceptual turn in language and philosophy type stuff too.
Right. And so, I mean, nowadays, I'll just say the way I like to think about it is I prefer to think in terms of sortal properties.
Sure.
Because I'm interested in the world and not as much our linguistic descriptions of the world or the way that we conceptualize it. I mean, all of that is interesting as well. But where I'm focused on is the world itself.
Yeah.
What's actually out there, the properties that objects have and so forth. So I like to focus on sortal properties. And these would be properties like being a hippo, being a tree, being a book, etc.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I imagine there's probably still like the anti-realists would not want to use properties, right? Is that still a beef in metaphysics that some people are saying, look, I don't talk about sortal properties, let's talk about sortal concepts.
Sure, yeah. Okay. So some people are anti-realists about properties, and so yeah, yes, right. They would presumably not want to talk about sortal properties. That's definitely a position that's out there. And I think that most of what I say in my dissertation and in this paper that we're talking about could be like translated into, nominalist friendly language. I haven't actually tried that, but
nominalists. Yeah.
You want to try to get rid of properties, you do the work.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. But I don't think that anything I say like really seriously depends on there being properties. It's just that I think there are properties and it's easier to say a lot of it, if you just speak as though there are. And so that's what I do.
Okay. Yeah, that helps. So we have different terms, different concepts, but we're going to prefer properties. When I checked the SCP entry on this, they said there's at least three things that people are doing with sortals. Sortals tell us about the essence of a thing. So sortals can tell us how to count things. And then sortals tell us when something continues to exist or when it like stops existing. Does that sound right? Would you agree with that?
That's one way of carving it up. Yeah. Also, there's a paper by Fred Feldman from the 70s where he lays out three different approaches to trying to characterize what exactly is a sortal and argues that none of them are equivalent. And this is why I said initially, the short answer is nobody knows what a sort is. Yeah. And that's because there are all these different ways of characterizing sortals, and arguably they're not the same. They're not equivalent to each other. Mm-hmm. So yeah, some of the ways of characterizing them are like the ones that you just listed. The counting one is pretty common. And the idea there is like, well, a sortal is something by which you can count objects. So like I can count hippos. I can't count greenness. So being a hippo is a sortal property, whereas being green is not a sortal property. That's the idea behind the counting approach, roughly.
Oh, okay. So what if someone said, like, I can count green things?
Yeah, exactly. So this is one of the problems that I think the counting approach has. So E.J. Lowe, is it Lowe? Yeah, I think so. E.J. Lowe argues in his book on sortal kinds and so forth. He's like, look, you can't count green things. I think he actually uses red things. But anyway, you can't count green things because like there's just no definite answer to like how many green things there are. And the problem, if I remember right, has something to do with like it's either like, well, how do we carve up and individuate green things, like what counts as a green thing. Or it might have something to do with like infinities or something like that. I don't remember exactly. But I think that Feldman has a response to this. Because Feldman says, look, I mean, surely it could be the case that there are zero green things, you know, in my attic or something like that.
Right.
And so at least some cases you can count green things. Yeah. But we don't think normally that green thing is a sort. Okay. Or similarly, he says, you know, there could be at least six green things in my attic, right? Like maybe not, maybe there's a problem about there being exactly six green things, but there could be at least six green things.
Well,
so that's one approach, and it does have some problems.
Okay.
Another problem with that approach, my friend Cruz raised, this was his first thought as soon as I told him this. He was like, well, what about mass sortals? So there are sortals that correspond to individual objects like hippos and trees, but then there are also like mass term sortals like gold and water and, you know, dirt and, you know, whatever, else, right? Matter, metal. And we don't normally think that those things are countable. That's why we distinguish between mass nouns and count nouns.
Between mass nouns and count nouns. So like, what if you had the whole lineup of in my safe, I've got, I don't want to say this because then someone will come and rob me and think I have this. In someone else's safe, there's a bunch of gold, there's gold jewelry and gold rings, maybe gold bars. They're not all jewelry, but they're all gold. Couldn't you ask like how many gold things are there?
Yeah, you could. But gold things and gold are not the same.
Yeah.
At least arguably, right? Like you might think, well, gold things are made of gold.
Yeah.
But then the gold that they're made of is different than the gold things that they make.
Yeah, that's good. Okay. I think we're going to have some fun with that too later. Oh, this is good. Okay. So,
I mean, maybe I should say this. So yeah, there are all these different approaches to like trying to characterize sortals, and they tend to have problems and they're not all the same. Here's the approach that I like, and it is kind of vague. And its vagueness sort of protects it from counterexamples.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, I liked when you can bake that in.
Yeah, but so one approach that some people take is like, look, there's an intuitive distinction between telling me what something is and merely telling me what something is like. So if I tell you that this thing is a hippo, I've told you what it is. If I tell you that it's brown or that it's a brown thing, I mean, I guess you would call that brown. I think I'd call it brown. You might say, well, you haven't really told me what it is. You've just told me something about what it's like.
Yeah.
So that's like an intuitive distinction, which I don't know how to analyze. But some people say that's the difference between sortals and non-sortals. It's, you know, does it tell you what it is or just what it's like? And the sortals are the ones that tell you what it is. That's the approach I like.
So does that, when you say it tells you what it is that picking out its essence or...
So some people think so. That is so some people want to say, yeah, when you tell me what something is, what you're doing is telling me like what its Aristotelian kind essence is.
Yeah.
Or you're telling me what its like natural kind property is or something like that. And then sometimes they will allow like in addition to that, like what are called restrictions of kind properties or kind essences. So that something like being a child, which is not an essence, you would treat it as, oh, well, it's a restriction of an essence. It's like being a human plus, you know, being, you know, biologically immature or something like that.
Oh, yeah. That makes sense. Sorry, my puppy is, he was stepping on my cords. So I had to grab him.
Puppy is a good example of a phase sortal.
Dude, I was just thinking that. I was and even using your distinction, your phasalism is like, oh man, dude, I can't wait to get in on that. Well, maybe we're already here with the Aristotelian kinds. Some people go in for what you call do you call it substantialism? Is that right?
Yeah.
And that's that a sortal is picking out the Aristotelian kind, and you can't lose that sortal without like losing the thing itself. Is that right?
Yeah. So it doesn't necessarily, I mean, whether we go Aristotelian or not is another question.
Oh, okay.
So think about this. So substantialism is my name for the view that some sortal properties are phase sortal properties and some of them are substance sortal properties. So what are those?
Yeah.
Well, a phase sortal property is a sortal property that an object can instantiate for a temporary phase of its existence.
Okay.
And so like being a puppy is a perfect example, because when that puppy stops being a puppy, it's not going to stop existing. It's going to continue to exist as like a mature adult dog, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so being a puppy is a phase sortal. And then a substance sortal property is a sortal property that an object can only instantiate permanently. And so one example of this, some philosophers think that being a person is a substance sortal property. And so they're going to say that when you started to be a person, that's also when you started to exist, because you can't, or you couldn't be a non-person and then become a person. And then they're also going to say, when you stop being a person, at that point, you will stop existing. You will go out of existence because you can't start out as a person and then become a non-person.
Yeah.
Person is a substance sort of. So for example, Lynn Baker holds that for you.
Oh, okay.
She's no longer living, but substance sortals, most philosophers these days who have a view on this are what I call substantialists. They think that at least some sortal properties are substance sortal properties.
Yeah. At least some. So if you go in for, well, let me just clarify. So puppy is a phase sortal because it's not picking up the essence of the dog, but dog would be a substantial. Does this remember?
So the essence thing is kind of, it's a related issue, but it's kind of a separate issue because so there's this view called sortal essentialism that says that ordinary objects all belong to certain sortal kinds essentially. And so, for example, I think that Lynn Baker would probably say this, she might say this somewhere about being a person. The idea is that not only are you a person permanently, but you're also a person essentially. Mm. So it's not possible for you to not be a person.
Yeah.
All right. So there's two different views here, one of which is a little bit stronger than the other, right? Like one view just says, you can't go from being a non-person to being a person and then back to being a non-person. If you're a person, you're permanently a person. And then there's a stronger view that says not only are you permanently a person, you're also a person in every possible world where you exist.
Yes.
So that view, sortal essentialism, entails substantialism, but substantialism does not entail sortal essentialism.
Gotcha. Gotcha. So that sortal essentialism is what I wrote down on the outline for you. Trans world sortals. Cause I was thinking about, cause like this, if you go in for sortal essentialism, then the sortal person can, you know, pick out my essence, and that will pick me out across possible worlds such that like you don't get to a possible world and see Parker the cockroach who's not a person. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So I think the way I would say it is that that sortal is a part of your essence, or at least it is one of your essential properties.
Yeah.
It's not going to be the whole of your essence, right? It can't exhaust your essence because obviously you're not the only person who has the property of being a person, right? Or you're not the only thing that has the property of being a person. So it doesn't like succeed in picking you out, you know, from everything else that exists, even in the actual world, much less across possible worlds. But it does do what you said, in that if you have being a person as an essential property, then across all possible worlds, the only worlds you exist in are worlds where you are a person.
Yeah.
And so there's no world where we're going to find a cockroach and say, oh, that's Parker.
Yeah, that's good to know. If you go in for that, I guess, do you go in for sortal essentialism? I know it's
perfect. So I reject sortal essentialism. So since sortal essentialism entails substantialism and I reject substantialism, I also have to reject sortal essentialism.
And someone's a substantialist if they have at least one substantialist reading of a sortal?
Yeah, if they think at least one Sordle is a substance Sordle.
So you don't think there's any substance Sordles?
Sorry, what?
So you don't go in for any substance Sordles?
Yeah, and I guess I should say this is a little bit rough, and it depends a little bit on exactly what counts as a substance Sordle.
Okay.
On my very, in some ways, kind of generous account, where it's just any Sordle property that must be instantiated permanently, there are going to be some kind of trivial exceptions. Like, for example, I think numbers are permanently and essentially numbers, and God is permanently and essentially a divine being and things like that, right? So I think there are some things that will technically count as substance Sordle properties in my sense, mostly like necessarily existing things.
Yeah.
And then also, like, you can, again, depending on how generous we are here about what counts as a substance Sordle property, you can rig up cases like, what about being a permanent hippo, where the property of being a permanent hippo is the property of being a hippo at every time at which you exist, right? Yeah. Like, okay, so technically that might be substance Sordle, at least on my way of spelling out substance Sordle. But barring those kinds of technicalities, right? Certainly, okay, like ordinary Sordle properties, like being a hippo or a tree or a car, right? I want to say those are, none of those are substance Sordle.
Interesting. Okay. So is it possible for a hippo to become a person?
Yeah. So in this sense, right? So right. When you first say that, it can sound weird.
Yeah.
Because of like a trick of language where it's like, well, but nothing could be both a hippo and a person at the same time, you might think. Though that's actually not entirely obvious to me.
Yeah, I don't see why. Yeah, sure.
But so even supposing that's true, my view only commits me to this. A thing which is at one time a hippo can be at another time a person.
Mm-hmm.
So it could like turn from a hippo into something else, like a person.
Yeah. Yeah. So when your paper is about identity, and I don't know what to make of your view. Like, some, when I first read it, I was like, yeah, this seems good. And then when I read it again, I was like, it seems nuts. And then I keep going back and forth. So like a puppy, like my dog, Theophilus is a dog, but he's in puppy phase right now. I guess that would be the phase Sordle that you could pick him out by, but he will cease to be a puppy, and yet Theophilus will still exist. I think everyone wants to admit that, you know, if he continues on his biological path.
Yeah.
But the puppy Theophilus, like, no longer exists, I would want to say. But help me think through that, because the phasalism seems like counterintuitive at first. Well, yeah. I don't know. At second, well, and third,
We should probably say what phasalism is, because I think we talked about substantialism.
Oh, yeah, maybe we skipped over that. Sorry about that. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, just to make sure that we don't get lost here. Yeah. So my view is phasalism, and I've borrowed that term from Dan Korman, who uses it in a similar way. He doesn't endorse the view, but he uses it in a similar way, and so I've just sort of appropriated the term. My view is that you know, basically any of these cases where an object sort of changes from one sort to another are phase Sordle changes, like the child growing into an adult or the puppy growing into an adult dog, right? Like, these are all changes where the original object doesn't stop existing when it stops being an object of the sort that it initially was. Yeah. It just stops being an object of that sort. So here's an example from Eli Hirsch. He talks about this case where a car is crushed into a block of scrap metal. Now, his view is, when the car is crushed into a block of scrap metal, it goes out of existence. Car is gone. My view is, it doesn't stop existing at that point. It just stops being a car and starts being a block of scrap metal.
Yeah.
And I want to say the same thing about, like, just any other, well, roughly any other Sordle change involving ordinary objects. So, like, if you've got a clay statue and you squash it into a lump, I say statue doesn't stop existing when you squash it. It just stops being a statue, right?
Yeah. Well, so it's just like the object still exists, right? But
yeah,
it no longer. So this is what's tough here. So the statue has certain properties, and when you smash it, it's no longer instantiating those properties, right?
It's no longer instantiating the property being a statue.
Yeah, and having a nose and resembling Adam.
Right, yeah. So it's going to lose a lot of properties. It's going to retain some as well. Like, it's going to retain the property being made of clay, for example.
Okay, that's good. That's good. Yeah. So there's this object there that's been there when it was a statue, that's there when it's a clay, when it's clay again. But doesn't it seem... But isn't the statue, like, gone? Isn't it, like, not there?
Yeah, so it depends on what you mean.
Yeah.
There was a statue, mm-hmm. and... in a certain sense, the statue is gone because it's no longer the case that there is a statue. Mm-hmm. But we still have a thing, on my view, that is, that we still have a thing which was that statue, right? Like, so...
Okay.
Yeah,
the lump is the thing that was the statue.
Yeah, the lump...
I mean, it's obvious, but when we're thinking about it at this high level, yeah, okay.
Yeah. And you know, even more succinctly, the lump was a statue.
Yes.
And it was that statue.
Yeah.
And it is no longer that statue because it's no longer a statue at all.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. But you'd say it's still the same object?
Yeah, the same object. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
And so,
And
I understand same object to be like classical numerical identity.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to do anything weird with that.
Okay. Okay. And so when Theophilus, my puppy, when he becomes an adult puppy, I don't know, somewhere around like a year and a half or something, let's say, he's like for sure an adult then. Theophilus, he is the same object that used to be the puppy, but is now an adult Bernedoodle.
Yep, that's right.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, that's when I read through, I got to this point again, but then I thought, well, there's all these people who disagree. And most of the metaphysicians studying Sortles, you say, are going for this term substantialism that you coined, I think. So what would a substantialist say to that? Why would they not go in for this phasalism here?
Yeah, okay. So there are a couple of things, I think, that motivate substantialism. One that I hear from some people is that it's just this intuition that in some of these cases of Sortal changes, an object is created or destroyed.
Yeah.
And I think that intuition is stronger in some cases than others. I do have that intuition to some extent, like in the case of the statue and the clay, you know, it definitely sounds right to say, oh, when the artist molds the lump into a statue, the artist has made a statue. Or more particularly, you could, you know, give the statue a name, you know, call it Bob, and you say the artist has made Bob.
Yeah.
And so that makes it sound like, okay, a new object has come into existence here. And then you might think similarly when you squash it, you might think, oh, it seems like, you know, it's not just that something stopped being a statue, it's that something stopped existing, you might think. So if you have those kinds of intuitions, I think that tends to motivate substantialism. And then another thing that seems to motivate substantialism is this idea that Sortles have an important role to play in criteria of identity
for
the objects. And that's what the paper was about, right? Yeah. So it's definitely very traditional to suppose that substance Sortles are involved in criteria of identity for ordinary objects. And Eli Hirsch has actually argued that you need substance Sortles in criteria of identity in order for those criteria to handle even very mundane cases of persistence. So what I'm up to in that paper is based a defensive move, trying to say, we actually don't need substance Sortles in order to get good criteria of identity. So I mean, one thing I don't do in that paper is I don't actually try to argue that phasalism is true in that paper.
Right.
I've got another paper in progress that...
Oh, sweet.
Relevant to that, but in this one I'm mostly just trying to say this defensive thing, like, look, you know, the substantialist doesn't have any advantages here when it comes to criteria of identity.
I caught that. I like that. I didn't know that about this other paper coming forth, which is a little spicier. I like that. Well, do you distinguish, is this just in the realm of like objects, would you distinguish between like objects and subjects? And like you know, for us, we're as a subject, maybe we... Because the substance dualists, of which I count myself, though I'm still in progress. I'm still learning and stuff. So I'm even like embarrassed to call myself anything. But substance dualists say, well, you know, like if you have the substantial soul, and they just differ on what that is, whether it's a substance or not or whatever. But that's how we can count identity over time. And I would think that would be like a substance sort of sorts, the soul. You see what I'm getting at there? Yeah. Like,
yeah.
It's just for material objects. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that I say in my dissertation that I'm limiting the scope of my discussion to material objects.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And so mostly I just kind of stay neutral about like, so Trenton Marix actually has argued that it's possible for an immaterial object to become a material object and vice versa. So if that's the case, then it seems like, you know, this phasalist view could easily be extended to even immaterial substances, but I'm not committed to that. I don't know whether he's right about that or not.
Okay. So yeah, phasalism, man, this is wild stuff. This is so good. I'm like, I keep seeing it and I'm like, yeah, I think he's right. And then I like lose it.
Well, maybe I should tell you part of why I think it's true.
Yeah, please.
If that would be interesting. Yeah. So my approach to metaphysics, I'm one of those people who really likes what's sometimes called common sense metaphysics or folk metaphysics. And so the idea is that there are a whole bunch of metaphysical beliefs and inclinations that ordinary people have about the world and its metaphysical structure before they start doing any fancy philosophy. They just kind of automatically, you know, adopt certain views or are inclined towards certain views about the metaphysics in the world. And I'm one of those people who thinks that, you know, those folk metaphysical beliefs and inclinations that, you know, we have them for reasons, and those reasons are often good reasons. And so when I do metaphysics, my method involves respecting folk metaphysics to a high degree. I try to retain as much of it as I can. I treat the components of folk metaphysics as enjoying like a substantial degree of protanto justification, so that you can't throw them out lightly. You have to have really good reasons.
Okay.
And so I want my metaphysical picture of the world to match up with the folk metaphysical picture as much as I can get away with reasonably.
Yeah.
And so phasalism, I actually think, is a better fit with folk metaphysics than substantialism is. Mm. And that's one of the big reasons why I like phasalism. And the way to see this, or at least the best way to see it, is any case where you have a candidate substance sortal change, like the statue and the clay, you're also going to have a material coincidence puzzle. All right, so here's like the famous puzzle about the statue and the clay. While the statue exists, it's in exactly the same place as the piece of clay it's made of at exactly the same time.
Yeah.
And normally we think, oh, well, I mean, you know, until you start doing philosophy and then people start telling you otherwise, normally we think, oh, yeah, you can't have two objects in the same place at the same time.
Right.
And so that seems like a pretty good reason to think that the statue just is the piece of clay. Right.
Yeah.
But what happens if you squash the statue? Well, like we were saying a minute ago, you know, it's a lot of people have the intuition like, oh, the statue has stopped existing, but the piece of clay is still there. And so now it starts to look like, oh, there are differences between the statue and the piece of clay. You know, one of them is still around, the other isn't.
Yeah.
But there can't be differences between them if they're just the same thing. And so now we've got a puzzle. Are they the same thing or are they two different things? Yeah. And one solution to this puzzle is phasalism. And it's just to say, look, being a statue is just a phase that the piece of clay goes through temporarily. And so what happens when you squash it is nothing goes out of existence. It's just the piece of clay stops being a statue.
Yeah.
Now, there are other solutions to the puzzle, but I think the phasalist solution fits the best with folk metaphysics. And one of the reasons, I mean, I won't go into all the details,
but
one of the key ideas here is this. A lot of the substantialist approaches to this puzzle introduce exotic metaphysics of some sort or another. They'll either end up saying that actually you can have objects in the same place at the same time, and that that's like ubiquitous, like that's happening all over the place.
Yeah.
And so there are actually a lot more objects in my immediate surroundings than I would normally think, and so on. Or they'll end up saying, like, I mean, another view is like the temporal parts view, which introduces the idea of temporal parts and says that, you know, persisting objects are spread out in time in something like the way that they're spread out in space. You know, they have different parts at different times.
Space-time worms, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so it turns out that, like, you know, normally you would have thought that the thing filling this person-shaped region right here in my chair, normally you would have thought that was the whole of me. But on the temporal parts view, it turns out to be a very small part of me,
right?
Which I think is pretty wild. And I mean, so, you know, these are cool ideas and I think it's good that there are people developing them and defending them, but it seems to me like, you know, the core idea of each of these is pretty not folk metaphysics-y. It's like, okay, let's introduce something kind of exotic. Whereas the core idea of the phasalist approach is the notion of a phase sortal change, which is present in folk metaphysics, because pretty much everybody thinks that like child to adult is a phase sortal change, right? Or that puppy to adult dog. And so we're not bringing in exotic metaphysics to solve the problem. We're bringing in something that's already present in folk metaphysics.
Yeah, that's really helpful. So in the clay, in the clay analogy, the clay is going through different phases, and so you can pick out a phase sortal to say statue or just lump. When it comes to child and adult, what are we picking out? What's the higher? What's the clay in that analogy or in that example?
Oh, a human being, I would say. Human,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you're asking, if I understand right, well, what is the more general sortal?
Yeah.
That is instantiated by the object that changes from being this kind to this kind. Like what's the sortal that keeps throughout the entire process?
Which would be the object, right? Isn't that the...
Yeah. So I was going to say, like, in the case of the child, you can say human being, but I actually don't think that there has to be a sortal that is retained throughout an object's entire life. Unless it's just like object, if you count that as a sortal.
Whoa. So, wow. What about, so that brings up identity, right? Like if it doesn't retain any sortals from, you know, point, from T1 to TN, which is like the end of its existence. What? Like, how is it the same thing?
Yeah. So let's work with an example.
Okay.
So let's go to the statue again, and let's say the statue is squashed and now we've got just a piece of clay.
Yeah.
And now let's suppose we take a tiny bit of that piece of clay and remove it, throw it out, and replace it with a bit of wax.
Yes.
We do the same thing the next day and the next day. And then eventually after a long time, we have a lump of wax instead of a lump of clay.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say that's the same object. It is now turned from a piece of clay to a piece of wax, right? And so now your question is, like, what is it? Is your question, well, what is it in virtue of which this is the same object?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So there's
a causal history or?
Yeah. Well, not on my view. I mean, maybe one could say that, but there's a few things to say here. So, I'm trying to figure out what the best place to start is, but I guess, all right. So one thing to say is I think there is something in common, like all the way across that series. It's just not a sortal. I endorse this view on which objects are what David Armstrong calls thin particulars.
Yeah. Okay.
Sure. Okay. So I think the objects are not just bundles of properties. They're the things that have properties. And so those are Armstrong's thin particulars. And so I think that what's going on here is there's a thin particular, which is initially a statue, and then it's just a piece of clay, and then later it's a piece of wax. So there is at least that thing, which is in common throughout the entire process, right?
Okay.
Now, there's what, a question here. It's like, well, but what are the criteria of identity for thin particulars? And that's the question that this newspaper answers, where I give my phasalist criterion of identity. I say, okay, you want a criterion of identity for phasalism? Here it is. It's the change minimizing criterion. And the rough idea of that criterion, it's very similar to Robert Nozick's closest continuer theory, but it's actually a little bit more indebted to Eli Hirsch talks about a change minimizing criterion. He doesn't endorse it, but he talks about it in some of his work. And the rough idea of the change minimizing criterion is this. So following certain other authors, I like to think about identity over time for objects as being like a matter of like, okay, there are a bunch of these different momentary states of objects that come in sequences or series. So like my life is made up of a bunch of like momentary states of a human being in a big long series.
Justin, is there a principled way to like slice up those time slice series? Like, or do they depend on, you know, maybe now you have this certain haircut and so it's that one's longer. Do you know what I'm saying?
They're all temporally point sized.
Okay.
They're all like just instantaneous.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Gotcha. They all have zero temporal duration.
Okay.
At least on the way that I'm thinking about them. Yeah.
Sure.
I like to call them ordinary object states. Other people use different terms. But yeah, the idea is like, you can think of these as, I mean, on my way of thinking about them, they're states of affairs.
Okay.
Not like temporal parts or stages, because I'm not a four-dimensionalist, but they're states of affairs, like the state of the object at that time, right?
And is that a concrete thing or an abstract thing? Or maybe both?
It'll be a concrete thing, because it'll be a state of affairs involving a concrete object instantiating certain properties.
Gotcha.
I think those are normally taken to be concrete. It's not like, there's actually in the literature two different notions of states of affairs.
That's why I ask, because I got deep in facts.
Yeah, so some people talk about abstract states of affairs that either obtain or don't obtain.
And when they obtain, they're facts, right?
Yeah, that's one way.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking of the concrete thing. So if you like talk of abstract states of affairs obtaining or not obtaining, I'm talking about like the obtaining of of abstract states.
Okay.
And so you get like these long sequences of them that make up the careers of objects in the world. And what a criterion of identity does is it tells you which sequences of ordinary object states are such that all of those states are states of the same object.
Yeah.
Okay. And so the criterion I defend is roughly what it says is only the change minimizing sequences of states are such that all of their states are states of the same object. And so the idea is like, if you follow a series of states up to a certain point and you ask, okay, where does it go next? A change minimizing series is one that says the next state in the series is whichever state at the next moment is most similar to the immediately preceding state.
Yeah.
So that's the rough idea. Let me try to illustrate this, get a little bit more concrete here. Here's a case that Hirsch talks about in his book. Suppose you've got a tree, and now consider like that tree's career is made up of a series of tree states. And then the trunk of that tree, its career is made up of a series of trunk states, right? But there's also a series of states that goes like this. It starts with states of the tree, and then at some point, it just arbitrarily shifts to states of the trunk, right? Yeah. That's a possible series of state. Well, it's an actual series of states. And there are infinitely many series like that because, you know, you could jump from tree to trunk at any point.
Yeah.
But that one shifts from states of one object to states of another because the trunk is not the same object as the tree. It's like a part of the tree instead.
Yeah. Right?
And so my one thing you want from a criterion of identity is for it to tell you why or to give you conditions which say that, oh, that's not a series of states where they're all states of the same object.
Right. And hopefully it's not arbitrary too.
Yeah. So you want the criterion to give you the verdict that, oops, you've just switched from one object to another there.
Yeah.
And so the way that my criterion does this, or my version of the criterion Hirsch originally introduced, is that it says, well, that series isn't change minimizing, because the shift from tree states to trunk states involves a bigger change than just staying with tree states.
Yeah.
And so, and this is actually that much Hirsch talks about. One thing I do is new and not just something Hirsch has said is, I end up saying that when we're talking about which states are more similar to each other, which determines which sequences are change minimizing, I end up giving sortal properties a lot of weight, as like, so that, again, very roughly, states of objects of the same sort count as being more alike than states of objects of a different sort.
Yeah.
And so that helps to ensure, although in this case, I think it's not really necessary, but it helps to ensure that the shift from tree states to trunk states is definitely not a change minimizing shift, because now we've shifted between one sort and another. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. So when you're looking at a series and you have this change minimizing criterion, what if the next, what if the next state is like radically different, but it's still the least, it still fits the change minimizing criteria because the others are so much more extreme.
Yeah. So then it's going to have the verdict that the object survives, provided that there's enough continuity there. So I do have a continuity constraint as well in the criterion, and I leave it in the paper really open-ended, like, because there are a lot of different kinds of continuity that some people have thought are important for identity over time. And for the purposes of that paper, I didn't need to take a position on like which kinds are important, so I left it open-ended. But I do think that there are some continuity constraints on persistence. And so as long as it also doesn't violate continuity constraints, then it's going to, on my view, be the same object. And so that's why this turns out to be a phasalist criterion, because like, so take the case of the car crushed into a block of scrap metal. At that point, when it gets crushed, we run out of car states that are continuous with the initial states in the series. But we still have hunk of scrap metal states, and they're going to be more like the final car states in the series than any other states at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to count as a change minimizing series from car states to hunk of scrap metal states.
Yeah.
And so by my criterion, it's going to turn out that this object that started out as a car survives as a hunk of scrap metal. So we get a phasalist conclusion.
Yeah. So we got that hunk of scrap metal and we start replacing its parts again. It's enough to satisfy the change minimizing criterion. And I just forgot the other name. What's the other criteria?
You mean like the one in the paper that I talked about?
Yeah, you just mentioned it.
The sortal criterion?
No. Oh, shoot, man. I wish I could rewind right now. Continuity?
Criterion? Oh, the condition, the other condition.
Condition, sorry.
Yeah.
Continuity condition. So we're satisfying these. But like further down the series, however long it takes to satisfy the criteria, we get a butterfly at the end.
Yeah.
Is that possible? Is that possible to turn that car to then crush it to then turn it into a butterfly and it be the same object?
Yeah. So if you imagine like, okay, so we crush the car and then suppose like, you know, the hunk of scrap metal starts to shrink and it gets smaller and smaller and then it starts to undergo chemical changes and then it starts to change shape and eventually you get a butterfly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So my view is going to end up saying that the butterfly at the end is classically identical to the car at the beginning.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Now, I should say, because I mean, a lot of people have intuitions against this sort of thing and they think, look, that's just too much change. The object is gone.
Right.
So maybe I should say something about how I deal with that.
Yeah, please.
So I appreciate that there are these intuitions, but I want to give them a different explanation. I want to say that when we have the intuition that the object has stopped existing in the course of a sortal change, it's not that the object has been literally destroyed, like it's literally stopped existing. It's that there's been a break in certain counterpart relations. So once you've got these ordinary object states that I talk about, you can also have counterpart relations between those states. And those are going to be like similarity relations, is the way people normally think about counterpart relations. And so then what I want to say is, and this is based on a similar idea from Ned Markosian, but what I want to say is, in order for something to be the same phi, where you can put any sortle in for phi, over a period of time or a course of change, it has to stand in the phi counterpart, or the its states at the earlier time have to be phi counterparts of its later states, right? So start with a car, we crush the car into a block of scrap metal. The block of scrap metal states are not car counterparts of the car states, because they're not even car states.
Yeah.
So that block of scrap metal is not going to be the same car as what we started with on my account, even though it is the same object.
Yeah.
Because the object counterpart relation for me is just the classical identity relation, right?
Yeah.
And suppose we keep going and we end up with the butterfly. Okay, well, the butterfly is not going to be the same car. It's not going to be the same hunk of metal. It's not going to be the same butterfly, because obviously there aren't even, you know, the butterfly is not, those are butterfly states. They're not car states. They're not hunk of metal states, right?
Yeah.
But also something else has happened, I think. And that is, all right, so the whole time we've had like a hunk of matter here that was first car shaped and then hunk of metal shaped, and now it's butterfly shaped. I want to say that that hunk of matter has changed so much. You know, it's so much smaller now and so on, and totally different shape. It's not the same hunk of matter that it was. So even though we have hunk of matter states all the way through the process, those at the end are not hunk of matter counterparts of the states at the beginning. And that kind of thing, my hope is that that kind of thing can account for our intuition that, like, oh, you know, the original object is gone. It's like, well, kind of. There's been a break in sameness of a certain sort, but not of classical identity.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, that is helpful. Yeah, I wonder, this is totally peripheral. But like when, like the car states and the hunk of metal states are not identical, obviously, we all know this. But like, if someone smashed up, if someone jacked my car and smashed it up in one of those, you know, compressors and turned it into a square hunk of metal, I think I would still own that property. It would still be mine.
A hunk of metal.
Yeah. Because it was my car. But then at some point along the series, and maybe this is like a problem of vagueness or something, but like when it becomes a butterfly, it doesn't seem like I own the butterfly. And this is like law. Now we're getting into ownership and who knows, right? But any like intuitive thoughts on that?
Yeah. Or here's a more extreme version. Okay. Suppose it turns into a child.
Oh yeah. That's good.
Or even just that, actually even better, an adult human being, right?
Yeah.
You would not want to say, oh, I own this human being, right? Like now slavery is suddenly okay. And what,
right. Because he's in the same series. Not.
Right. Yeah, so here's what I want to say about this. There are moral properties that, you know, become relevant to sortle changes, but what I want to say is they don't track, or at least they don't necessarily track classical identity. They instead track the sortles. So that, like, if there are certain moral properties that attach to being a person, for example, then as soon as a thing becomes a person, it now has a new moral standing than it didn't have before.
Yeah, tracks the sortles. That's good. Okay. And like you said, the whole series doesn't have to have any sortles in common from the beginning to the end.
Yeah, at least on my extreme view, I guess.
Yeah. Man, this is so good. Well, Justin, what? Oh no. I like the thin particulars take. On that view, if you're applying that to human beings, like, what are we? What's the thin particular that?
Oh, yeah. So, I waver between two different views on what human beings are. Some days I like substance dualism, and some days I like animalism.
Okay.
So just to make sure that the audience is tracking, I don't know who all is watching, right? So substance dualism, we mentioned earlier, is the view that a human person is either an immaterial soul with like a body that's associated with it, or they're like composed of an immaterial soul and a body. So the soul is like a part of them instead of being identical to them. Mm-hmm. And the body is the other part, right? And then animalism is the view that a human person is identical to the human animal, that, you know, if we, you know, we think of ourselves as like advanced animals, right? Like there is some kind of animal sitting in my chair right now, some yeah. organism. The animalist says, that's you, you're that thing. Mm-hmm. I have toyed with the possibility of combining these two views, mm-hmm. But I haven't really thought about this in a lot of detail, but I've sometimes thought, well, look, you know, the kind of substance dualism that seems most attractive to me, the emergent substance dualism that people like William Hasker defend.
Sure. Yeah.
And you might think like, look, why couldn't, you know, like a conscious field or, you know, however it is he thinks of the soul that emerges yeah. from an organic system, just be considered part of that organic system. It's not a material part, but right. why couldn't it be part of it? And then in that case, why wouldn't it just be part of the organism? And so then you could say both, that the human person, you know, you could be a substance dualist and also an animalist. The human yeah. person is both the composite of soul and body, and it's an organism.
Yeah.
So that's a view that I've like toyed with a little bit. And in some point in the future, I want to think more about that.
That's awesome. I've been thinking about that a lot as well in the exact same way. So that's pretty cool.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
It's so good.
You had asked about, what was
thin,
it?
Thin particularism. So like,
yeah.
Oh, on that view, it would be like the, you are the soul on the thin particular. I only know thin and thick through like a hylomorphist reading. So like on the hylomorphist reading, like a thick particular is the,
oh,
you know, form and matter, but on a thin particular, it's just the form.
Right. So I should say that I'm not super familiar with the hylomorphist literature. And so sure. I don't want to try to tackle that just because yeah. I will probably no just say things that are false. But thinking about it non-hylomorphically, so it seems to me, if you're a thin particularist and you're also an animalist, then what you're going to be saying is this: the animal that you are identical to is a thin particular that instantiates properties like being an animal and being a person and so on. Right.
Yeah.
And so you're both identical to an animal and identical to a thin particular, because the thin particular is the thing that is you, and it also instantiates being an animal.
Okay.
And then on the substance dualist view, let's take the version of substance dualism that says you are identical to a soul.
Yeah.
Not that you have a soul as a part, but you just are.
It's good. Soul, right? It's a good one.
Take that view. I think that the thin particularist is going to end up saying this, that you are, again, identical to a thin particular. But one of the properties that that thin particular, you know, has is the property of being a soul.
Yeah.
So the thin particular is the soul.
Yeah.
And it's you, and you're the soul, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so good.
That's how it would go for that version of substance dualism.
Okay. That's awesome, man. This was super good. I wanted to finish up because you talked about this in the paper, mm-hmm. Because it's the background is Vision from WandaVision, and for those who have seen it, there's two Visions at the end, and they're kind of arguing with each other. And to sound really smart, they say, you know about the ship of Theseus from identity metaphysics. And I asked all my philosopher friends, they're like, yeah, we don't call it that. That's weird, but it sounds kind of smart. So we could go either with Vision or we could go with the ship. Can you help us think through the ship of Theseus or the ship of Visionists, on a Phaselist account?
So I actually still have not watched WandaVision, but I've heard,
I just spoiled it for you.
Oh, no, don't worry about it. I mean, I've heard a little bit about the ship of Theseus in it. Yeah. So here's the puzzle of the ship of Theseus, and I'm going to give you Hobbes's version because that's the cool version. All right. So we've got a ship, and it's called the ship of Theseus, and it's made of wood. And then, you know, somebody decides, hey, one of these boards is getting kind of old. Let's replace it with a newer one. So they take a board off the ship of Theseus, and then they replace it with a new one. And then, they do that again And again, and over a long period of time, eventually all of the original boards are replaced by new boards. And so now we've got the original ship and this whole process of replacement that has led us to a ship made of new boards.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it's tempting to say that the ship made of new boards is the original ship, because at any rate, a lot of people have the intuition that a ship can persist through gradual turnover of all of its parts.
Yeah.
Okay. But now suppose that all the old boards that have been replaced, they're all laying around somewhere. And somebody comes along and takes those old boards and puts them back together in exactly the way that they were when they originally composed that ship that we started with.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Here again, it's tempting to say that this ship, which is made of the reassembled old boards, is the original ship. Because, again, a lot of people have the intuition that, like, you can take a ship apart and put those boards back together again and get the same ship again. Mm-hmm. You can reassemble the same one. Okay, so now we've got a puzzle, because we have two ships, the one made of the new boards and the one made of the reassembled old boards, each of which seems like it should be the same ship as the original one. But they also seem like two different ships because they're in two different places at once and they're made of different boards, right? They seem like different ships. And so it's like, well, how can two ships be one ship? How does that, you know, how can two things be one thing? So we've got a puzzle here, and it's a fission puzzle.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there you go. but anyway, okay. So how do we solve this puzzle? Well, there are a ton of different solutions that have been suggested. And the reason this comes in my paper is actually because I'm illustrating a certain point about the criterion that I defend. It's meant to like illustrate a certain objection to that criterion that I talk about. But forget about all of that. Let's just think about what we do about this puzzle, right? Because
people can
read the paper if they want to. They're probably more interested in like, how do we solve the puzzle of the ship of Theseus, right?
Right.
I mean, the solution that I go for is one that says that the ship made of new planks, you know, after that gradual replacement process is the original.
Hmm.
And the ship made of reassembled planks is not the original. And that's because given certain other views that I hold, my change minimizing criterion ends up having that consequence, that the ship made of the new planks is the original, the ship made of the reassembly planks is not.
Hmm.
However, it also has the consequence that if you don't replace the original planks, if you just take the original ship apart and then put the planks back together, then you do get the original ship again. The reassembly is the original. So whether you get the original ship when you put the old planks back together depends on whether you, there's that other one out there that you know, where you gradually replaced the planks. Some people think this is really counterintuitive. I think it's only counterintuitive if you think that there is like a metaphysical, like grounding type explanation.
Oh, yeah.
Facts about identity. I deny that, and I talk more about that in the paper. So I'm okay with this kind of view. And in fact, what I do is I end up giving a causal explanation of what is going on here. I say ordinary objects all have conservative dispositions, mm-hmm. which means that they are they try to sort of stay the same. I mean, this is speaking anthropomorphically. They try to stay the same as much as they can, but you know, they retain their properties as much as circumstances allow. So they don't want to change a whole lot. They want to change as little as they can. And so the idea is, well, the ship of Theseus has this conservative disposition. As you start to replace planks one at a time, each plank replacement is just a very small change.
Mm-hmm.
And the only alternative to just persisting through that small change for the ship is to just stop existing altogether, which seems to me like a really big change.
Yeah.
And so the change, because the ship has this conservative disposition, it ends up persisting through this process of gradual replacement of the planks. And so by the time you go to reassemble the old planks, the ship is now over here made of different planks, and so it's not available to be reassembled. So
yeah.
But suppose you don't replace the original planks. Suppose you just take the original ship apart, and now you've got a pile of planks. Well, because objects have these conservative dispositions, those planks are disposed to compose the same ship again when they're arranged appropriately.
Mm-hmm.
And so given that there isn't, you know, that ship didn't survive because you didn't replace the planks and it's not out there somewhere else, right?
Yeah.
If you put those planks back together again now, they're going to compose the original ship. And so you will get the original ship reassembled.
Yeah. And that seems really intuitive, even just thinking about like a car. Like you your mechanic could take your car apart and then put it back together, and you don't have to go to the DMV and re-register or anything like that.
Yeah.
But let's say they don't, you know, the classic one, like we said, is to replace the parts. If they don't replace the planks, they take it apart to exactly 50% and they replace the other 50, they reassemble the other 50% over here. So now you have two assembled halves of the ship of Theseus. Now you have like the next sequence, the next move in the sequence is either going to make one more and one less, or this one more and this one less of the ship of Theseus. Like, does that complicate things if we do half and half, exactly half and half?
Let me make sure I understand the case you're imagining. So you're saying, well, okay, suppose we remove half of the planks from the original ship.
Yes.
And are you saying we're removing them one at a time, like gradually?
Yeah. Okay. And maybe we're reassembling over here those same pieces.
Yeah. So you start to put like, okay, so you take one plank from the original and put it over here.
Yes.
Then you take another plank from the original and you like attach it to the one over here and you start building another half of a ship.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So my view about what's going on there is going to be basically the same as the view of what happens in the original case. Mm-hmm. The original ship, because of its conservative disposition, is going to persist through the gradual, like, okay, losing one, another plank, rather than just ceasing to exist, which is like this huge change.
Yeah.
And so you're going to end up with this pile of planks. And as long as that original one is still existing in that like remaining half of the planks, anything you try to build out of the other planks over here is going to be a different ship.
Okay. What is it? Does that go all the way down to the last like nut and bolt? Or
yeah. So I've actually been thinking about this recently because I still need to work out some of the details of my view about disassembly and reassembly.
Yeah.
But currently I lean towards the, like if you gradually remove the parts, then the original object continues to exist all the way down to like, almost to the very end.
Okay.
I have this view, this hasn't been published yet. It's under review somewhere, but I do have this view that there are certain kinds of part loss that destroy an object.
Okay.
Well, it has to be, I'm not going to lay out all the details, but like if you lose a big enough part all at once or an important enough part all at once, roughly, that can destroy an object all at once. And this ends up being built into my continuity condition in my criterion. All right.
Okay.
And so there are scenarios where like, if you were to like, just take the ship of Theseus and split it in half, like the Titanic, that could destroy it all at once.
Okay.
But if you're doing this, like one plank at a time kind of thing, you're not going to destroy it until you get down to maybe like the last couple of planks and then you divide them apart from each other.
Yeah.
And now what you have left, that remaining object, you've basically just split like roughly in half. And so,
All right. Last thing on this, just really quick. And again, like you said, you're still working it out, but what counts as gradual? Cause I can imagine, you know, setting up a machine to disassemble, and you could set the machine to take off a part every 5 minutes. And that seems like it might be gradual, but then you could, if it's a machine, you can go all the way down and say like, well, 30 seconds or 10 seconds or.
Oh yes. Good. Yeah. So actually using the word gradual here is a little bit of a, it's not exactly accurate. And that's because it actually doesn't, the time is not what matters as far as my view goes. It's more of the increments. And so it's a matter of continuity and not about like slowness or fastness.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
So even if you like took the, you know, if you did one plank at a time, but you did it at like super speed so that it all happened within a second.
Yeah.
Still one plank at a time. And so one small change following another. And so I'm still going to say, yeah, the ship actually persists through that. It just at some point stops being a ship.
Yeah.
And it even at some point stops being the same, hunk of wood, because I'm going to say that the hunk of wood counterpart relation is exceeded at some point in there. Like there's not enough of the same wood, you know?
Yeah. Are sequences that follow each other, are they, you'd call those counterparts? Like this sequence here is followed by this one, and they're counterparts of each other. Cause when I think of counterparts, I think of Lewis, and I know you're not using that in the same way, but Lewis's counterparts weren't identical. And so I'm wondering if you have counterparts in the series, do we even have identity at all?
The counterparts are the states, those ordinary object states.
Yeah.
So those are numerically distinct from each other.
Okay.
But the object that is in those states is often going to be numerically the same object.
Gotcha.
So this is like an endurantist twist on counterpart theory.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. In fact, so I don't know if you know, so stage theory is like what you get when you take David Lewis's counterpart theory, but apply it across time instead of across worlds.
So what's it called? Stage theory?
Called stage theory.
Stage theory. Okay.
And it's been defended by people like Ted Sider and Catherine Hawley.
Okay. Yeah,
so
sure.
The idea is like, you know, the way that objects persist over time is you have a bunch of momentary objects that are counterparts of each other.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens to you, like facts about what's going to happen to you in the future, the truth makers for those kinds of statements, like that you will exist tomorrow, are you have a temporal counterpart tomorrow. There's a stage tomorrow that is a counterpart of you.
Yeah.
So that's stage theory. My view, I sometimes describe as stage theory for endurantists.
Okay.
So I'm not a stage theorist. I think that there are objects that persist over time by being identical over time.
Yeah.
But they have all these different states at different times, and those states can stand in counterpart relations.
Yeah. So that state of affairs has the same object, even though it's not the same state of affair as its previous one.
Yes. Yes. So you can have multiple states that are all distinct states, but states of not the same object, like numerically the same object.
That's good. That's interesting. Wow. Well, Justin, this has been so much fun, man. Thanks for like schooling me on this stuff. It's been really, really helpful for me. Just thinking through like Sordles and you kind of left me here like thinking like, oh no, like now there's this view that most people don't agree on but it's good. So I really appreciate all your hard work in this and your paper. Again, that just came out today in Nous. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. It was just published today.
Okay.
Awesome. Or the day that we're recording this. I don't know.
Yeah, when it's released. That's true. That's a good point. Good job. Leave it to the philosopher. Well, that's awesome, man. So I appreciate your work. And if someone wanted to find out more of your work, like where could they go?
Yeah. So I have a website. It's just justinmooney.net. Mooney is spelled with an EY on the end. Yeah. And then I've got all of my published work is there
awesome.
On the website. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And I'll leave a link in the description wherever you're getting this podcast at. Well, this has been fun. Hopefully we can get Justin come back on and school me even more and all of us on some metaphysics and philosophy of religion type stuff. But for now, that's going to have to do it. This has been Parker's Pensies. And as always, all glory to God.